Oh, that's right. Good afternoon, everybody. Hey, I'm Ann Eller right here with you on WCRS. And I have snagged the big interview here. I have Police Chief Gerald Brooks with me here today. And he agreed to come sit down and talk with me if I did the talking. And what did you say? You were a good listener?
I'm a good listener. If you carry the conversation, I'll listen intently.
Okay. I hope we're going to get something out of him here today. So, how have you been doing?
I've been doing well, thank you. I hope you have.
I have. And I'm looking forward to getting some input. You know, I think it was last year sometime, I was at a meeting and you gave a talk. And one of the things that you talked about was how much more difficulty that you or law enforcement in general is having on hiring. How is the hiring situation here for you here in Greenwood?
You know, I guess I'd have to characterize it as fairly dismal. This day and time, it doesn't seem like there are many people that want to start a career in law enforcement. Years ago, after the attack on the World Trade Center, 9/11, people were lining up. They had seen what happened in New York, and they felt called to serve. And we had people wanting to be firefighters, police officers, EMTs. Those were good days for us in terms of recruiting. We got some real good quality people. After a few years, though, it kind of leveled off and went back to the normal level, what it had been for quite some time. And that continued on really right up until the events in Ferguson, Missouri a couple of years ago. And after the things that happened in Ferguson, and there were a lot of other events after that that got a lot of media attention, and much of it put law enforcement and the law enforcement career in a pretty negative light. And it really, really had a devastating effect on recruiting, that is, young people wanting to get into law enforcement. And I don't really know how long it's going to take that to rebound.
Well, is it money? Is that part of the problem? Is it just the desire to serve?
You know, I guess money has probably always been a problem. Mm-hmm. But most of the people that are in law enforcement knew the salary. You know, they knew what they were being offered, and they weren't looking for a big money job. They were looking for a job where they could serve. And they obviously, nobody's in law enforcement for the money. I can't help but think that...
Oh, now, wait a minute. We have heard stories about that. But that's another day. Okay.
do believe that more money may be an incentive for some people, may get them to take a second look at us. But having said that, the real problem right now, I believe, is that there's a perception in much of our citizenry that law enforcement's not something they want to be part of these days. It's just been portrayed in a negative light across the nation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, young people have a lot of options these days, and many of them are opting not to pursue law enforcement as a career.
Sure. Now, do you have any positions open?
We do right now. As you and I speak, we have two positions open. They have both been open for more than 6 months. And,
wow.
Again, we're just not able to attract the caliber. I'm not saying we don't get any applications, but I'll also tell you that not everybody belongs on the law enforcement bus. There are some people that put in applications and they simply aren't qualified, or they're not the type person. They don't have the skill set that we're looking for. And the worst thing I think we can do is hire the wrong person. Those wrong people are the ones that put you on the front page of the paper in a negative light. And so we have to pick and choose and be real careful that when we do hire somebody, they're going to represent us well and be the type of officer the community be proud of, as opposed to, look, let's fill this position so
sure.
It lightens our load a little bit.
But I also understand that most of the people that you have on staff have been there. You have a good, well-trained staff that have been there for a good while.
We do. Fortunately, our attrition rate slowed to a trickle. It's pretty rare for us to lose someone now. The people that we have, we're just as proud of them as we can be. We know that they're good people. They're people of good moral character. And we invest an awful lot of time, effort, and resources, energy into their training to make sure that they do this job the way it should be done. And I would not swap our police officers for any officers in any other agency I can think of.
You know, one of the things that I was interested when I was reading the article about the new police vehicles and how they're all in the paper the other day was how much that laptop is an integral part of their life.
Oh, it is. You know, the days of the pen and paper are pretty well gone for law enforcement.
Right.
And it is actually... It makes our officers more effective. They don't have to look for a place to go and sit down and write a report. And it used to be, you know, everybody who was working in a zone was trying to find some friendly location where he could go and sit down and have a desk and a lamp and a chair that he could write the report. Now they're sitting right there in the patrol car. And it keeps them out in the field, keeps them from coming into the office. Also, they can access a lot of information that makes them more efficient, more effective. And so it's a valuable tool. I wish they were less expensive. I wish that there were fewer technical glitches. But having said that, we wouldn't try to, I don't think we'd try to do this job without them these days.
It's got to be a big change for you, having been on the force and everything, though. I mean, when you look at the technology and how it has changed the job.
Well, I can remember the days of typewriters and carbon paper. And now we're encountering people that don't know what a typewriter is. They haven't seen one.
Right.
And wouldn't know that carbon paper has two entirely different sides. And if you put it in between the pages the wrong way, it doesn't work.
There you go.
That's a skill that is not important anymore.
Not important. That's true. Well, since we're talking about this part of the job and everything, how do things work as far as getting people to, are we having a big problem with keeping people in jail that should be in jail? You and I were talking a little about the revolving door. Just seems like people are in and out so fast. So do you see the same criminals over and over again, Gerald?
We sure do. You know, you're in the retail business, and so I think you know that repeat customers are important to your business.
They are very important.
Well, unfortunately for us, we see a lot of repeat customers. It's generally the same people. It's a small percentage of our population, but it's the same people that we're dealing with all the time. And again, for the most part, our criminal justice system these days is somewhat of a revolving door system. I guess we've got enough time for me to tell a true story. I got got contact from a business person several months ago complaining about a drug dealer next door to her business, and it was hurting business and bad for the neighborhood. And she was able to provide enough information that we said, well, shoot, this is something we can fix. It was such a tight, close-knit neighborhood that our officers really stuck out like sore thumbs. It probably took us 6 weeks or so to get the information that we needed that we could get a valid search warrant and go and search this drug dealer's residence. But we got the search warrant. We went and searched his residence. We found the drugs. We found some cash. And we arrested the guy. Because of the activity, the cars, the blue lights and stuff, this person that had complained to me about it knew, well, okay, the police came and they arrested the guy. Thank goodness. The next morning she called me. She was pretty irate. He was back. And when I checked on it, I found that even though this was his second offense and we had charged him with possession with intent to distribute, a judge let him sign what we call a PR bond, a personal recognizance bond. And that is, all he did was he signed his name on a piece of paper and he walked out. No money, no attorney. He just signed a piece of paper and walked out. You know, she was pretty irate, and understandably so. It caused her, I believe, to lose confidence in the police and their effectiveness. Well, we stayed after it because this guy didn't stop doing what he was doing. And within just a few weeks, we were in position that we could get yet another search warrant. So we went back, and we surprised him a second time with a search warrant. Again, we found drugs, and I believe the second time we found a gun. At any rate, we put him in jail. The next morning at his bond hearing, a bondsman was present standing by. This time, a judge set a $20,000 surety bond. The bondsman signed it for him. He walked out. He was back in the neighborhood by 10 a.m. We don't give up easily. A few weeks later, our patrol officers working at night patrolling the area on foot, encountered the automobile that he used. The engine was running. The windows were open. There was a strong smell of marijuana. They approached the car. Ultimately, this guy ran. Our officers chased him, caught him, and again found marijuana on him. We arrested him and booked him into the jail for the night. The next morning, he again signed a personal recognizance bond.
How can this be?
Walked out. Didn't even need a bondsman that time. Just signed his name on a piece of paper and walked back out. At that point, we're wasting resources if we try to make a fourth charge against him or a fifth charge against him, because right now we've already got three charges in General Sessions Court pending against this guy. And we know that because of the backlog in cases in General Sessions Court, we know that it'll probably be 3 years or more before those cases ever even come to court. Meanwhile, he's still out. Now, believe it or not, I think there may be a happy ending to that story. And that is, there is a state law that is not often used, but it provides that a place that's often used for repeated drug activity can be declared a public nuisance. And if so, a judge can file an injunction against that place or issue an injunction against that place, and it can be padlocked for any use for 12 months. And if the property owner or someone violates that injunction, they're subject to a penalty of 6 months in prison or a $10,000 fine or both. And so we had a sit-down meeting with the property manager or owner and brought that to his attention and explained to him, this is what's going to happen. You're going to lose it because of your tenant. And to make a long story short, he evicted the tenant. He's agreed to sell the property to Habitat for Humanity. Working with the city, they're going to demolish the place, and it's going to, you know, they will rebuild something nice there where they can get a good tenant in there. But my bottom line is this, it ought not be that hard.
No way.
And our criminal justice system is just, it's not serving us the way it's supposed to.
Well, it seems like if not every day, every other day, that there are drug arrests, and more drug arrests. There are some domestic criminal violence, and there are some pulling a gun or pulling a knife or this type of thing. But a lot of it is drugs, Gerald. What is going on? Can the sheriff's department and the police department, can they get ahead of the drug problem? What's the honest answer here?
Well, first let me tell you that it's not like this is unique to Greenwood. This is in every community all across the United States of America.
I know that.
And I would tell you that if there was any police chief in our nation that had solved the drug problem in his community, his picture would be on the front page of Time magazine. I believe he'd be man of the year. And all the rest of us chiefs and sheriffs would be picking his brain, you know, friend, how did you do it?
Right.
But this country has a drug problem. And as you well know, I believe it was either 1970 or 71 that President Nixon declared a war on drugs. Mm-hmm. Well, so now what? We've been fighting that war maybe 45, 50 years or so, and we've made no progress. We're no better off than we were. In fact, I think the drug problem is more prevalent now than it was back when President Nixon declared the war on drugs.
So I thought maybe it was just that more people were getting caught than used to get caught.
Well, I would say yes, our arrest numbers are up, but the reason they're up is that more people are doing drugs than they used to. And I think maybe all of us know about what it will take, but we're not willing to do it. And let me draw a comparison there to the war in Vietnam. Most every month that war went on, the United States had the ability to end that war at any time they wanted to. They had ships out in the South China Sea that were capable of obliterating any target, and they could have ended that war decisively had that been the will of our country. But that wasn't what the people apparently wanted. And now I think we know there are ways to solve this drug problem, but we don't have that will. I think the people in law enforcement do. But as far as the politicians and the people they represent, we're not willing to make the sacrifices that it would take.
Well, we keep hearing the discussions about the wall for between Mexico and our southern border here, and the discussions about how many drugs or how much drugs is actually coming across the border. And last night, what was I watching? Something on Fox News, and this gal was saying that if Americans didn't want the drugs, they wouldn't be coming across the border.
That's right. You know, it's, if you ever took the economics in high school or college, it's supply and demand.
Yeah.
And as long as there's a demand for drugs, as long as people here want the drugs, there'll be somebody willing to supply them for the right price.
And it just seems that the prices are getting cheaper. In fact, from what I understand, they're even able to make the meth, and they're bringing meth across now. It's not just something that's cooked on the cooked on the stove now.
That's right. That's right. There's been a change there. When meth was first in this area, it was being brought in. It was imported. And then people figured out, well, there's a way we can make this ourselves and make it cheaper. And since then, other manufacturers, particularly in Mexico, have found out, well, there's a way we can make it better and in larger quantities, even cheaper. And so that we're seeing, once again, meth being imported into our area rather than people cooking it, you know, in at home, in the car, in a motel room, whatever.
So we have the drug problem. How about any other problems that we have a lot of here in Greenwood, as far as we have drugs, domestic violence?
Well, again, we have our fair share of that. That's very unfortunate. But again, that's in every community, and it's truthfully, it's in every neighborhood. It's in your worst neighborhoods, is in your better neighborhoods also,
right,
all across the board.
When Governor Haley, former Governor Haley, now set up the initiative, has that made a difference in how it's being approached?
Maybe some. Mm-hmm. And some improvements, a whole lot better than no improvement.
Sure.
But it's still a problem.
Okay. Well, we're at a positive place here this afternoon. It is a shame, and because I know that everybody that's in law enforcement works very hard. I go to Washington, D.C. In fact, we'll be going the end of June to do an immigration radio row where we'll talk with ranchers and people that are down on the border and what they've dealt with and this type of thing. And while I talked to a couple of them just a couple of weeks ago, and I asked if anything was any better, and they said, truthfully, no, it's still not any better. Now, we have seen where President Trump is putting his foot down, and ICE is going to be more demanding and be on the border. How about immigration issues here in Greenwood? I remember a few years ago when somebody would call the police, the sheriff, whatever, would pick up illegals, and then they would end up letting them go because the federal government did not want to take them. Do you think that's going to change, Gerald? Or do we have an issue of immigration here in Greenwood, illegal immigration?
Well, we certainly have a population of immigrants, both legal and illegal. Having said that, the immigration laws are not laws that local law enforcement can enforce. Those are all federal laws, and so they have to be enforced by federal agents. For instance, at the police department, we are empowered to enforce the city ordinances and the South Carolina state laws. Beyond that, you know, we're not empowered to enforce the federal laws, and so we're basically not involved in the illegal immigrant process. And the truth is, that's probably a good thing, because they are here and they reside in our community. And our job, what we really want to do is we want to keep everybody in Greenwood safe. That's our mission in life, is let's keep everybody in Greenwood safe. Mm-hmm. Well, to do that, you've got to have a rapport with the people. And if the illegal immigrants think that we're after them, then we're going to have trouble contacting them, going to have trouble interviewing them, going to have trouble interacting with them in any way. And so I think it's good that I believe they finally have caught on. Well, the police aren't going to grab me because I'm here illegally. They don't ask for my green card or whatever. The only reason they're going to grab me is if I'm involved in some other criminal activity. So we're really not not close to the immigration enforcement. That's just not one of our functions.
What about as far as if an illegal immigrant does do something illegal and is caught, brought up on it, what would happen then?
Well, that has varied from administration to administration. And there I'm talking about, depends on who's president,
right,
and which party has the majority in Congress. And at times, the situation has been if an illegal immigrant was arrested for a serious crime, then we were directed to notify the immigration authorities. And generally speaking, they would come and get them and deport them. What we found out was that wasn't too effective, because about 6 weeks later, they were back.
Come back to our area. Like, if they came out of our area, they'd come back to us.
Yeah,
they wouldn't go someplace else.
They came back. And so, you know, we regretted even notifying the federal authorities, because we had them charged with a crime. We had good evidence. We could have convicted them. We maybe could have got them, you know, 10, 15, 20 years in the penitentiary.
Right.
Instead, the feds picked them up. Told us they deported him, but, you know, 6 weeks later, the guy's back and he's causing more problems. And so the next time we arrest him, I guess we misdialed the number because the feds never showed up to pick him up.
So you were able to convict him, I guess, of a crime.
That's right. And felt a little bit better about him going to the penitentiary as opposed to going back to his home country. But then the administrations would change, and the next administration would say, no, we don't want anything to do with it. We're overworked. They've cut our budget, blah, blah, blah. No need to call us. We're not going to do anything. And so it varies, and we just kind of have to roll with the punches.
Okay. All right. Listen, I'm here with Police Chief Gerald Brooks. We're going to hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back. Don't you go away.
Gold. Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I could actually hear the intro there. That was pretty good. We've had a little issue going on here, but other than that, we're doing good. My very special guest this afternoon, Police Chief Gerald Brooks. And we've been talking about a lot of issues that are going on, needing a couple of more police officers there, the revolving door. Do we think there's any possibility of the criminal justice system, the trying of cases, keeping people in jail? Do we see any changes in that? I haven't seen much action on that in the budget or anything. Down there in Columbia, a lot of conversation about that.
You know, Ann, I'm not real optimistic about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bottleneck in our system, and this is South Carolina. I truly don't know what's happening in Georgia and North Carolina.
Right.
But in South Carolina, there's a bottleneck in our system, and that is that we don't have enough circuit judges to serve this state and keep the system working like it should be. And our legislature is not willing to appropriate funds to hire more circuit judges because, you know, they don't want to raise taxes, and I can appreciate that. I'm a taxpayer myself. But they don't want to raise taxes to hire more judges. And I think that if you look beyond that, one reason, or there are many reasons they don't want to hire more judges, but one thing is if you hire more judges, then there's more bench time available. And when that happens, that means the solicitor offices mm-hmm. all across the state need to add personnel, and the state would have to fund that. And as soon as you add personnel to the solicitor's office, you've got to add personnel to the public defender's office. And when you do that, you're going to have more convictions and send more people to prison, which means you've got to build more prisons and you've got to hire more corrections officers. And so I think our legislators, you know, in their eminent wisdom, see that, gosh, if we were to increase the budget and hire enough judges to make this thing work, then all of a sudden we've got to spend all of this other money. And, you know, they're sitting down there, they're resting, they've got a limited amount of funds to deal with, and they're thinking, well, everybody's talking about infrastructure, then we need to do something about our highways, we need to do something about our bridges, but, you know, we don't want to raise the gasoline tax, and we need to do something about the retirement system, and they've got just so many needs for funding, and they're representing people that don't want to pay more taxes.
But one of the problems is we have more people coming into the state. I mean, just look at what the size and scope of how Greenwood has grown over the last few years and will continue to grow as industry comes in and all these things happen. It just looks like it's going to become a bigger and bigger problem. I mean, that case that you talked about where it was going to be 3 years before somebody would even go before before a judge or their case would come up. What happened to that law about a right to a speedy trial?
Well, for the most part, if that's what you want, if you want a speedy trial, you have to request it, and you have to request it in writing. And the average defendant is told by his attorney, you don't want a speedy trial. The longer this thing waits and the staler it becomes, the better the chance that either I can help you avoid trial or I can get you an acquittal or you'll be dealt with less harshly. And so most defendants are not interested in a speedy trial. Now, maybe they would be if they were sitting in a jail cell.
Right.
But as I told you, they're out on bond. And so why bring that to an end and have to go to prison? Why not just remain out on bond and let other people ask for a speedy trial?
Well, so that will be another elephant that we'll have to deal with it someday here in South Carolina, as far as the justice system and running things through.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, one of the things that I know that is on the docket that's supposed to be coming y'all's way is a new communication system. Do you have any info on where that is at?
My guess is that we're just a few months away from that being up and running. I know that contracts were signed and equipment was ordered, and my understanding is a fair amount of that equipment has arrived. I believe they're waiting on a few more critical pieces to arrive before they begin the installation process. But I think we're probably looking at maybe March or April that the new system will be up and running.
Now, what exactly will that mean to y'all?
Well, for the police department, it's honestly not going to mean a whole lot. We had our own radio system. It worked well. It works well today. It serves us well, and it truly meets our needs. The problem was, though, with the county agencies, the sheriff's office, the county, the rural fire departments, they simply did not have 100% coverage in their areas. And when their system was studied to see what it would take, it was going to really be cost prohibitive to enhance their existing system. And so the determination was made that it will be better off joining what's known as the Palmetto 800. It'd be just more cost effective. Mm-hmm. And so since the county was going that way, we needed to go that way because we need to be able to communicate with them. And that's what brought the city into it, is we needed to be able to communicate with the county when they made the change. And so for the police department, won't make a big difference for us, but for the county agencies, it'll be a real plus. And they need it. There's no question about that. They need a better radio system.
Okay. And then what about body cameras? Is that something that has been, do all the police officers wear body cameras now here?
You know, again, the funding was the problem, but mm-hmm. fortunately, the funding has been more or less forthcoming. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not mistaken, we have issued the purchase order that when that equipment arrives and is installed, we'll be at the point that all of our officers will be equipped with the body cameras. Right now, probably, I'm going to estimate maybe a third of them have the body cameras now. But we should be kind of fully built out on that in just a few months.
Do you see the body cameras as a good thing?
Yes, I sure do. They're real good for us because, first and foremost, the public expects that these days. And so when the public expects us to have something, we need to have it, but everybody wants to see it for themselves. They don't want to hear about it or take your word for it. They want a picture. They want video. And so we'll be able to provide that. And almost invariably, that video serves us well. We're, you know, again, now if you've got bad officers doing bad things, those body cameras may be a problem for you. Mm-hmm. But we've got good officers doing good work, and we don't mind that work being filmed.
Now, you know, so many times on TV and in a lot of the areas where they are having problems and everything, you see people filming, just regular citizens filming an incident. We've seen episodes where the police have told them to get back behind this line and be away from this area. Do we ever have any situations like that here?
You know, we've had citizens that would walk up with their smartphone and begin filming. But again, we don't have any problem with that. We should be doing our work in a manner that we've got nothing to hide. And so the more footage of it, the better. And the truth is, you know, you're not going to film much of anything with a lot of accuracy if you only have one camera lens. If you've ever watched a television show, if you've ever watched a movie, I can assure you there were multiple cameras from different angles capturing that. And our body cameras only get in it from one angle. And so if there are other body cameras on the scene, if there are citizens with cell phones, the more footage, the better, the more complete, accurate record you'll have of that event. So we don't mind that. Now, were some officers caught off guard? You know, maybe so, but fortunately that was happening in other jurisdictions. And so we were able to learn from their mistakes because a lot of jurisdictions mishandled it, and they would command people not to film it, and they would seize their phone if they caught them filming it and stuff like that. That's not in keeping with the Constitution. If the person's there and has a legal right to be there, then they also have a legal right to video what they're seeing.
Now, what about the status of race relations in our community? From what I see, it seems like things are pretty good. Some of the things that we've seen, Ferguson, Baltimore, Charlotte, I mean, some of these areas, I don't see that same type of thing as far as, or even the antagonistic attitude that we see in other parts of the country. How are things from a police standpoint?
Well, I certainly think that in Greenwood, they're certainly better than average. Like most people, I don't limit myself to Greenwood. I do just a little bit of traveling. And when I go into other communities, there are some communities that I go in, and I'm almost jealous because my perception is I don't detect a lot of animosity. Everybody seems to be getting along well, a lot of harmony here. And I go to other places, and you can almost feel the tension and the friction and the animosity, and I think, well, gosh, I'm glad I don't live here, and I look forward to getting out of town
right.
in just a few moments. In Greenwood, I don't detect a lot of that animosity. I think we get along well, and I think Greenwood is known for that. We've never had the problems that a lot of other communities have had. Go to a lot of public meetings, meet with a lot of community groups, and generally feel like we're well-received, and it's a two-way street. We as police officers need to conduct ourselves in a fashion that we're not perceived as an occupying force, but that rather we're protectors. We're here to keep people safe. And if we treat people with dignity and respect, if we follow that golden rule, then I don't think we'll have a lot of problem.
So are you saying in other communities that things have gotten off base partially because of the officers?
Yes, ma'am, I'd have to say so. I've seen that with my own eyes. I've seen, in my career, I've seen a lot of people wearing a badge and a gun that I really don't believe had any business whatsoever in law enforcement. They just weren't suited to it. And not everybody is. Just like everybody's not suited to be a teacher, not everybody's suited to be a doctor or a nurse. Mm-hmm. And using me as an example, I'm not suited to be on the radio.
Oh, you've got a face for radio. No problem.
I do have a face for radio. I've broken a few cameras in my day.
You know, I'm always curious about, as you look at your job and you look at the job that you do day in and day out, what do you think there are any specific problems that need more work here in Greenwood?
I wonder if you could rephrase that. I'm not sure I follow that question.
Well, any problems? I mean, we know that drugs are a problem, but are there any, and we know domestic violence, but is there anything that we can overcome with these issues? Maybe that's a better asking of the question. The drug issue, is there any way that we are going to overcome it, or are we just going to be looking in the newspaper, seeing who got arrested for drugs this time. And from our perspective here at Sharp Facets, we read the paper to see who got convicted of drugs, who may or may not be coming in our doors right. with things to sell.
You know, I would love to be real positive and upbeat and, right. and all, but the truth is I'm a little bit more of a straight shooter than that. I'm going to give you the facts, whether you like them or not.
Just the facts, man.
I don't see us solving the drug problem. I think that I think the solution could be compared to a three-pronged or a three-legged stool, and you've got to have all three legs, and we just don't have that. Now the one leg is law enforcement. We in law enforcement have invested a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money, a lot of energy. We've done everything we can to do our part. And in law enforcement, we really play two roles. And one is interdiction. We need to try to catch the drugs before they make it to the user. And we work hard at that. And tons of drugs have been seized by agencies all across the United States. So yes. Law enforcement works hard at the interdiction. Our second big tool there is arrest. We need to arrest people that are involved in the drug trade. And now there's a lot of people that will say, well, don't arrest the drug user, you just arrest the dealer. Well, I understand that logic, and we do target the dealers in a big way. But we talked about economics a while ago, as long as there is a demand, as long as you have users wanting the drug, someone will step up and supply that. And so there has to be a way that law enforcement can balance this and strive for arresting the dealers and distributors, but also there's got to be negative consequences for the users. But in law enforcement, that's what we're doing. We're making arrests, and we're involved in interdiction. But we're only one leg of that stool. The other two legs, one of them is I would call it the prevention leg. We've got to stop people from ever using drugs. And you can't wait until they're in their 20s to do that. That's something that has to start in the home when they're young children. And it needs to be reinforced in the schools. It needs to be reinforced in the churches. It needs to be reinforced in the media, whether it's television, movies, music, news. Everywhere any person goes, they should be educated, and we should be focusing on prevention so they never, ever use those drugs. And if we can accomplish that, then one of these days, eventually, it stands to reason, we'll dry up the demand for drugs. And once you've dried up the demand, then the supply is going to naturally go away. But on the opposite side of that, this third leg is the addictions. We have to be able to treat addictions because so much of our population has a drug habit that they can't kick. And the medical profession, and my hat's off, I'm not trying to bash any doctors here because we couldn't get by without them, and I've received benefit of some mighty fine medical care in my day. But the medical profession has not found, I think, the solution to treating addictions. Most of even the stellar places that treat drug addictions are telling you their success rate is, 10% for this drug, 20% for that drug, less than 50% even for alcoholism. And so that tells me we've got an existing population that's going to keep the demand in place. And as I've said before, you're always going to have the supply. So until we address prevention, treatment for addictions, and enforcement, all three very effectively, we're going to have a drug problem. And again, our governments and our population, we're not willing to make the sacrifice that would take. And so just like we weren't willing to make the sacrifices it would take to win the Vietnam War, and contrast that to we were willing to make the sacrifices to win World War II. Mm-hmm. But we haven't been willing since then to make the sacrifices. And as a country, we're not willing to make the sacrifices that would be necessary for us to solve that drug problem once and for all.
You know, we could kind of look to what has happened with smoking. Cigarettes.
Right.
I mean, that the prices have gone up tremendously. We have seen, and there was a program of intense, you don't want to do this. I mean, people still smoke and everything, but they pay a hefty price for doing it.
Right.
So, and so we have seen the benefits of people not having the lung cancer has gone down and things like that.
That's right.
You know, before the legislature is a law to legalize medical marijuana here in South Carolina. What do you think about that, Gerald?
Well, I'll start to tell you, I don't believe there's any such thing as medical marijuana. If you'll check, none of our pharmacies have marijuana. The FDA hasn't approved it. There's a federal law that prohibits it. And the American Medical Association has come out saying that this is not medicine. So I don't think we're ready for it. Now, there is another side of that coin. There is proof out there that there are some components of the marijuana plant that can be beneficial. Mm-hmm. And two of them are currently available to people. I think one is known as THC, mm-hmm. and then one is known, I believe it says CBD, something like that. Some people refer to it as the marijuana oil or something like that. But two of those components are now available in pill form and have been approved by the FDA. But this medical marijuana that the push is on right now, this is actually, I mean, this is the whole plant. This is people wanting it in a smokable, edible form. Mm-hmm. And the places that it has been tried, it has not worked out well at all.
Meaning like Colorado?
That's
state?
Right. Oh, they've, gosh, check and see what's happened to their accident rate, emergency room admissions, things of that nature. They're paying the real price for what they've done there. And I don't think we want to see that in South Carolina. Now, there's a large percentage of the population that does want to see it, but I'm afraid I'm not in that group. And again, the top drawer doctors in our community would not prescribe marijuana if it was legal. Who ends up writing those prescriptions are the doctors that can't have a practice because people won't come to them. They don't have a good reputation. They're perceived as quacks or incompetents or whatever. And so those guys get a little retail location on the corner where you come and get your prescription, and you walk in and you tell the guy, you know, I'm in pain and I need a script. And he writes this little certificate, and then you, because it won't be a prescription because, again, it hadn't been approved. Then you walk down to your pot shop and you get your marijuana. And what they are finding is that the biggest population of people that are buying, and I'll call it a subset of our population, the people that are purchasing this medical marijuana are males between the age of 18 and 35.
Okay.
And that's the healthiest population in this country is males between the ages of 18 and 35. But they're the big purchasers of this so-called medical marijuana. And it then gets in the hands of others. But, again, the American Medical Association has said, you know, marijuana in its smokable form is not good medicine.
All right. Well, so we've covered a lot of topics here. I've got one more, the concealed weapon that they were talking about. I think they have. Have they passed that where we will have a reciprocal agreement? I'm not sure it's been signed by the governor, but I think it's gone through the system where people that have a concealed weapon from another state or something are going to be, we will have with the whole country. Is that what your understanding is on that?
It looks like it's probably headed that way. Let me say this, and I don't have a problem with the concealed weapons permitting process in South Carolina. There's a background check, and there's some training, and it has worked fairly well. Unfortunately, some other states, basically you pay a fee and you're walking out with a permit. There's no
right.
training that goes with that. And
exactly.
I have a little problem with that because a firearm is a pretty doggone dangerous thing, and I would like to see people that are going to possess it and carry it. I'd like to see them be people with a good background and have adequate training. You know, we would require a lot of training before we let that 16-year-old drive a car. And I'd like to see maybe that much training before we let somebody walk around on our streets with a firearm strapped to their
well,
side.
We really don't require that much training, do we, for the concealed weapon now? I mean, what, one day of training,
well,
basically?
It is. In my mind, it is a very minimal amount, but at least it's something. Some states don't require any training.
You're listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. So that would, I guess, concern you, that we could have people coming into our state that don't have any training.
That's right, yeah. And two kinds of training. I mean, I'm real big on firearm safety. We need to be sure that they can handle the weapon safely, but also there needs to be some legal training that they know when they can use that weapon in accordance with the law and when it needs not to be used.
Yeah, it's I think it's, and you're right, without some type of training, it would be nice if there was a little more training to even what we do here in South Carolina.
That's right.
Because I don't think they get a lot, but such as it is, I guess a background check is a good start, right?
It's a good start.
It's a good start.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that we should talk about here today, Gerald?
You know, I couldn't think of anything when I got here, so.
I think we've had an excellent conversation then this afternoon.
Okay, great. Well, I hope I rose to the occasion. I thought maybe you needed a disclaimer there to tell anybody that might be driving they need to pull over the side of the road and stop in case I put them to sleep.
I don't think that. I enjoy having you on the show, right, Gerald, and I enjoy your frankness in discussing the issues that are part of our county, and I think the public does too. So thank you very much for being here today, Police Chief Gerald Brooks.
Well, thank you. I appreciate what you do.
Thank you very much. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. We are going to be done now, so thanks for listening, everybody. I'll be back in the morning. Bye-bye, everybody.